This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain!
This is Dunaway's Buy the Flowers.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
Don't stomp your little last season Prada shoes at me, honey.
Is butter a carb?
Snap out of it!
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy? Security!
I can't stand to have you touch me! I can't stand to have you look at me! Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
John Callio, will you go round with me?
What a strange girl you are.
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
You have no idea how bad it gets.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
You bitch! I wish I knew how to quit you.
You are on Outtakes, the queerest film show in, well, anywhere, I think.
The world.
My name's Daniel. I'm joined in the studio by Alan, and we're welcoming back Conrad.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's been
the first time we've all three of us together.
No time like the present. It's been such a big week this week in Hollywood. Most notably, perhaps, Academy Award nominations. Everyone's talking about it.
Exciting stuff.
What did you think?
Few surprises in there. I think it's always the ones that cause the most drama is who was left out.
Yes.
You know, so you kind of hear lots of people going, what about this person and what about this person? But, I mean, there's always going to be people left out, right?
And always a lot of comments about prejudice, racism, which are not always the most well-founded comments, I don't think.
It is being, what is the hashtag on Twitter about this Academy Awards? The White Oscars or something.
Yeah. but
you kind of sums it up if that's your feeling about
it. The last three Best Director winners, for example, were not Caucasians. A Mexican director, Asian director. And for the Best Performance categories, I don't know that there was anyone, perhaps not Caucasian, who actually deserved to be nominated this year.
That's a whole nother show. I bet you we could find someone who could take us through everyone who missed out.
You know what, this, as you say, this happens every year. You know,
representation.
Well, speaking of representation and films not nominated, one of the surprises was the just released here in Australia, Carol, which was not nominated for Best Film. And unfortunately, the film's director, Todd Haynes, who we're going to speak a lot about tonight, he was a queer cinema pioneer and has such an impressive body of work. He didn't receive a nomination for Carol.
It is strange how a film can get nominations for things like Best Picture or Best, you know, performances by different actors, but there's one missing in other categories that are directly related to that. Anyway, it is all subjective, I guess, but it was a shame that he missed out because it was a great film.
You know, as in the director's category, the other directors which have been nominated all produce really solid work. So, you know, this film, Carol, is one of the better films of the year. It's a really strong film, and it's a shame not to see Haynes there. But the other nominees are all solid competitors. I don't feel the same way about the Best Picture nominations. So, for example, The Martian, entertaining perhaps to an extent, one of the better films of the year. I don't think so.
I'd agree with you on that one. I don't think it's one of the better films.
And it's a shame to see it there instead of Carol.
It's the pool of the big names. You know, you've got Matt Damon in it, and it's the political world that Hollywood is.
Definitely Ridley Scott as well.
Well, the Academy Awards are becoming increasingly political. Do you think the Academy Awards are ready to nominate, if not make win, what is essentially a lesbian film?
Yeah, I was reading something about Carol today that said one of the reasons why it took so long for it to get made wasn't that it was a lesbian film, but it was a film about two women. And I think if you look at all of the kind of big films that are nominated this year and the ones that have been left out, the argument keeps on coming back.
That is a really interesting observation because, of course, you know, we were saying earlier, The Danish Girl would have been a welcome addition to that list of Best Picture nominees. Again, a female, strong female-driven film. You know, I think Suffragette could have easily made the list. Even Joy, which I didn't appreciate, which has a strong female lead, could legitimately have been on that list.
That argument about representation and what is left out, I think, is a valid argument to have each year. I think if you don't continue to look at something and assess it and make sure that it is representing what is out there, then you're not really doing your job. So it's kind of, I expect that argument to be kept on being had.
Yeah, I think...
keeps everyone in line.
Well, we do want to talk...
it does.
...talk a lot more about Carol tonight. In fact, we're going to dedicate the show to Carol and also to a kind of retrospective, I guess, of Todd Haynes's work. Haynes himself is and was a pioneer of new queer cinema and has continued to produce and direct and write really important work.
He really takes his time, doesn't he, though? He's got eight films and a few, like quite a few shorts in there as well.
In
and
about a 25-year TV period.
And
stuff.
And there's, you know, you're looking through his IMDb and you're like, oh, 4 years between that. You know, like I think that's a mark of someone who's really passionate about what they do. They obviously want to get it right. And when you look at his work, he does.
And it's about the quality.
Selective. He's very selective in the work that he does. And all of the work, I think, mediates very similar themes. So, you know, he's not doing work for the paycheck. His work, he's building a body of work that says something about the world we live in and about the life of his characters, but also our lives.
And they're not usually stories that are front of center in terms of what's going on in the world. It's obviously something that he's very passionate about. He looks for something that resonates with him, and then he builds this whole production around it, which sometimes takes a long time. So,
and that's what's so interesting about his collaboration here with Highsmith. Now, Highsmith is obviously no longer with us, but Highsmith was a writer who really delved into the psyches and the lives of the characters that she, you know, wrote about in her novels. And that's why so many of her films have been turned into, of her books have been turned into really interesting films. The Talented Mr. Ripley, Strangers on a Train, just recently The Two Faces of January. She really does evoke nuanced, interesting, flawed and quite dark characters. Carol is one such character. And this is Blanchett talking about bringing to life a Highsmithian character.
The gift of working on something based on a Patricia Highsmith story is that the interior life of the characters is so rich, and she's masterful at dealing with characters who, and acknowledging in a way that every adult has a secret.
It's a really interesting point that Highsmith does deal in the trade of secrets. And if you think about her other work, all of the novels she writes deal with a kind of crime of sorts. And here in Carol, the crime is love and a relationship between two women.
And the fact that the story itself, I think what's resonating with a lot of people is with Carol is that they're not punished for it in that direct way. They don't suffer for their, you know, life choices. Some terrible things kind of happen because of the relationship and her marriage that is still kind of unfolding and things like that. But they actually are openly quite in love with each other. And that's the thing I think that is so refreshing about the movie.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I think particularly Kate in particular, I think, conveys that very well, that sense of love. But getting back to your point and how they didn't, they really they didn't suffer for their love. Mm. I think that's one thing that wasn't very well explored in the film was Kate's character Carol and the impact this relationship had with her daughter.
Mm.
You know, I'd say that was a pretty heavy price to pay.
It was, but it was one that they didn't, that she came to terms with and didn't walk around with it as something that she completely, you know, overwhelmed her.
Yeah,
you know, she actually, it was real to life in that she got on with it.
I mean, what's so interesting about this film, because Carol is such a strong character, and at the same time, she has to deal with a lot, and you feel like she's going to fall apart. Without giving too much away about what happens, you know, she holds on, and she's quite strong, and that's, you know, at the same time, you want to hate her for not falling apart, but you also can't help but love her because she is so strong.
Absolutely. And she's very vulnerable in a positive way. Her emotions are all there, but she holds it together. She's stoic without being stubborn.
We are talking about Carol here on Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9. We are, of course, talking about Carol, one of the most anticipated, certainly one of the most anticipated queer films of 2015, 2016. And we've been talking about the character of Carol, how strong she is, but also how vulnerable she is. And I think that has a lot to do with Cate Blanchett as well and her nuanced performance and the way she brings this character to life.
Absolutely.
And we were just talking off air about the non-verbals that Kate was able to bring to it with her look and her body. It just really took, you could just really sense the pain and the anguish that she was going through.
And while that is in large part because Blanchett is such a versatile and talented actress, it's also because the character is so well written. And the funny thing about Carol, about the book, actually it was published under the name of The Price of Salt, under a pseudonym, because Highsmith didn't want the themes in the story to be associated with her body of work, certainly not until the mid-90s when it was actually published under her name. But, you know, one of the things about the book is that it's all told through the subjective kind of narration of Therese, the character who falls in love with Carol. And Phyllis Nagy, the screenwriter, worked for a very long time on actually bringing the private life of Carol into the story so that we do, you know, we do get to see things about Carol that aren't really explored in the book. I was really lucky to sit down with Phyllis Nagy earlier in the year and have a discussion about this work, which, you know, has been critically acclaimed, and in fact she's just received a nod from the Academy for Best Adapted Screenplay.
It's a great scoop. It's a scoop for Outtakes.
Well, look, she's lovely and she's really talented, and she stuck with this project for 18 years. You know, she wrote it in the early 90s, just after meeting Highsmith, and it went through a number of directors, a number of studios before Haynes finally signed on and Blanchett and Mara signed on. So, you know, I was really interested to talk to her about that kind of perseverance. The film only took something like 35 days to shoot, but 18 years to make. Wow. So I did ask her about that, and this is what she had to say.
Yes, it took 18 years.
18 years, my goodness.
To bring it to the screen. And then, of course, it all happens very quickly, and at least the shoot in 35 days.
So why did it take so long, 18 years, to bring Carol to the screen?
Well, I think there are several reasons why it probably happened that way. I think that when we were first starting out with this, it was quite a different time if you think back to the late 90s and the kinds of films that were being financed. Very few of them were financed with female lead, and this is certainly a film in which the two largest roles, and arguably the third largest role, is also a role for women. It just, that was one of the major problems. And since the part of Carol is such a particular thing, she is, you know, a quintessential Hitchcock blonde of sorts.
Absolutely.
Certainly a Grace Kelly type. And there are very few people who could actually have done it. We never got to the stage of even pre-production where we were ready to offer things. It seemed that every time it was ready to go out, the leading female stars were 10 years too old or 10 years too young, or they were completely not the right kinds of actors for this. This was a huge problem. So it wasn't so much it wasn't the gay content, I don't think. It was the female leads, period pieces, which are always difficult when you're trying to do a film outside of a studio. Yeah.
The kind of grit and determination that you must have had to rally for Carol to be made over 18 years must have taken so much. I'm wondering what it was about the story that led you to push for it for 18 years.
Yes, well, I felt, it's a funny thing, films that take a long time, and there are, you know, many of them, perhaps not 18 years worth with this result, but they do have a tendency to linger around the more difficult projects, the trickier ones, and usually there's a moment when you can step aside, maybe in the first 5 years or so. But once you get past a certain point, it becomes more, damn it, I'm not going to leave now, not after all of this. And, of course, a lot of the time that's spent in those years is downtime. You know, there are moments of frenzied activity or people expressing interest, directors, financiers. There's a flurry of easy work, and then nothing. And so there was quite a lot of time to reflect on how to prepare for the next campaign. Yes.
Well, because there were so many different directors attached to this project over that 18-year span. I'm wondering how the script changed and evolved over the course of those different attachments and over the course of the 18 years.
You know, it takes so much time to get things made, but people get other jobs. And it seems to be, film seems to be one of those things where directors get very passionate and hot about something, and then if it doesn't happen.
Well, as a writer, that must be very difficult to work with and to still hold on to your vision for the story.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you know, I learned how to deal with lots of people's input in the best possible way and realize that, you know, most people are reasonable, and even if there is an idea that I know is completely and utterly wrong, the convincing comes in actually doing that work, because somebody will turn around and say, oh God, that's right, what was I thinking? It's one of the reasons why the integrity of the adaptation has been maintained.
I do want to talk about the adaptation for a moment. I thought it was so magnificent, and I know you've been getting high praise from a number of different sources and institutions, but what I love so much was that Carol really isn't dramatized all that much in the novel, except when she is with Therese. She really is a kind of alter ego of Highsmith and of Therese, and you've done such a wonderful job at shifting perspective so that we do get to see behind Carol's mysterious facade. I wonder what kind of imperatives you brought with you when you sought to flesh out Carol's character.
Well, one of them was to make sure that she's a very Highsmithian character.
She is very Highsmithian.
In that, there's a profound air of melancholy or trouble to Carol. And it's fascinating because she is otherwise quite a decisive, quite a brave person in her way. And so the things that I strove to keep about what I felt Pat was interested in her book was that element, for one thing. She's not a femme fatale. She is just a very strong woman in a difficult position. And she's also a fantastic mother and has some very difficult choices to make about what will make her the best possible mother to her child. And also there is no psychologizing about the state of her sexuality, and nor is there in Tourette. And those are the things that are present in the book that I thought were absolutely astonishing and ahead of their time and still ahead of their time. And so that is what I strove most to preserve.
That did come through. At the same time, watching this film, I so loved Carol and I felt so sorry for her at times. But at the same time, I was so frustrated with her as well. I found that the film really didn't make any judgment and tell me what to feel about her. And as a movie goer, that was quite an interesting experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at films from the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, there's a complete lack of judgment and a move away from a sentimentality that really honors the audience's adulthood. There is no other way, really, to say that. That it telling someone what to feel and insisting that there is only one way in which to view the proceedings is infantilizing. So, you know, that was paramount for me and also for Todd and also for Kate and Rooney, who had no need to play characters who were loved. You know, you see a lot of love me acting going on,
yes.
Right? Not in this movie. Just that could we present a scenario whereby people were just behaving in a way that was honest and true to themselves? And would that communicate favorably to a wide cross-section of audiences? And for me, that was the big experiment of Carol. And I hope that we have largely succeeded in that.
I think you have largely succeeded. And certainly this has generated so much buzz. And for you, after 18 years, that must be so gratifying. I was surprised to see that Carol is actually based on someone that Highsmith actually met in a very similar role to the job that Therese has at the start of the film. But based on my reading, yeah. You know, I found out that this lady had a very different end to Carol in the film. And without giving much away, I wonder why you think Highsmith chose to end the story quite differently to this lady's real life experience.
Well, Highsmith became a sort of almost a stalker, but the woman
isn't every writer a stalker of sorts?
Yeah, she wasn't aware of it, and I think typical of Pat to choose an object of some obsession who, let's say, meets the end she meets.
Yes.
It seems very Highsmithian. But the novel, of course, was written long before that happened. So I think it's just one of those quirks of coincidence that ends up being quite Highsmithian.
Yes.
But there was another woman, I think, the ex, who had some sort of child custody issue that Pat obviously wove into the novel.
Yes.
Though in a strangely minor way, of course, the film compresses everything, makes slightly more of that because it's one of the very real obstacles Carol faces.
Yes.
But, you know, it was the only time I know of Pat admitting that there were real antecedents for her work. I know that there were others, but not as strangely autobiographical as this one.
There she is, the now Academy Award-nominated Phyllis Nagy. And it's so interesting how some of the most fascinating stories are born out of real-life circumstances.
Absolutely. And it's those stories that can get lost if there's people, like, you know, with people like Phyllis not passing them on.
Yes.
That's something that we would never have known.
The perseverance to stay with a project for 18 years. And, you know, every time a new director comes in, they want the story told in a different way and you have to rewrite and redraft. That would be heartbreaking.
Absolutely. We've had a message come in from Lucas and he said, Carol is a beautiful movie, but nuanced as you have all said. I think that's why it may not have resonated so much with the average filmgoer or the Academy. The viewer needs to work to appreciate it. It kind of sums it up, really.
You do need to work to appreciate this film because, you know, I think Haynes doesn't ask us to engage in the world that he gives us. The 1950s New York that he evokes is not one that is immediately engaging. You do have to kind of work to appreciate this world, but it does really pay off at the end when you do get that payoff if you do work to kind of involve yourself in the story.
Nicely put.
Well, you know what? I think we've had a discussion about this already. I definitely got the nuance, definitely understood what Todd was trying to convey and what Kate was trying to convey, and also Therese in their characters. But at the end, I actually found that the film really did leave me cold at the end. I'm definitely not a fan like you two and some of the others. For me, it was an average film. I did not connect emotionally.
Scandal.
I know.
I love that.
But I didn't connect. I didn't connect with Carol. I didn't connect with her. I didn't connect with Therese.
You know, I don't want to give too much away about the ending of this film. And clearly it didn't work for you.
No.
But it is different to the ending that we traditionally get in stories like this. And that has been often said about this film. And I think it is one of the reasons why a lot of people like it. So it's interesting that it didn't work for you.
Which could be the reason why it's not working for other people.
Yes.
I never
would have thought of it as being a polarizing film. But no. When you said that, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, because people like resolution when they watch a story. They want to know, they want to be able to leave the cinema and leave the story behind in a way. And this film doesn't, without saying too much, it doesn't entirely let you do that.
Oh, no, I disagree. I think the film really does. I think that's the thing that I liked the most about this film was the ending. That was the best part. That's where I could definitely really responded to the ending, and that was amazing.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9. We are, of course, talking about Carol and Haynes. And, you know, we've said a lot about Blanchett's performance, which is remarkable in this film. She's nominated for Best Actress here. She probably won't win. I don't know that she will, but...
Let's take that as a soundbite for when we our post-Academy Awards follow-up.
Well, who do you think is going to win?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. That category is a strange one this year. There's no clear front runner, I don't think.
I wouldn't count her out. Let's say that. I think it's like a very tight race.
I think she's a bit young to be on three Academy Awards, and I think the Academy might take that into consideration. I certainly hope they take that into consideration when considering Jennifer
Lawrence.
Thank you, Jennifer Lawrence. Yeah, because I don't want to see her with two.
Come on, Kate could be this generation's Meryl Streep. And for her to get a third award.
And she probably will
third award.
I hope, you know, she is.
She's well on the way.
Yeah, why not?
This is what she has to say about talking with director Todd Haynes.
He's so intensely visual, and the references that he brought to bear on this. I mean, he's made films about sort of people who are on the outside or people who think differently to the mainstream in one way or another, but he's treading visual terrain here that I've never seen him tread. It's so a whole lot of reflections. So you see the characters actually often recede within the reflection of the society in which they're inhabiting. The taxis going by, the cabs, the passers-by. So it's a very subtle, delicate aesthetic that he's working with. But he's so buoyant and so full of feeling and good humour and generous to a fault, you know, to everyone on set. He's so wonderful to work with.
She's so eloquent.
She is.
I could listen beautiful. To her speak.
She is.
All evening.
And watch her speak.
True.
And it's so interesting hearing her talk about Haynes in this way as someone who is subtle and delicate, because, of course, 20 years ago, you know, no one would use those words to describe Todd Haynes. He was aggressively experimental, which is why he was or is a father and a pioneer of new queer cinema, which was anti-establishment and which was aggressive. And in fact, if we look at his very first big film, which was actually a short film called Superstar, this is a really aggressive, shocking film almost, and the way it's made, it tells the story, of course, of Karen Carpenter, who had very famously struggled with a number of imbricated eating disorders, and the whole film is shot using Barbie dolls, so there's no one actually, but they whittled away at the Barbie doll that was Karen Carpenter until there was virtually nothing there, and they superimposed pictures of, you know, bombs dropping in Second World War, and this is pastiche and irony, and, you know,
statement.
Everything that would come to define new queer cinema.
Also very confronting, seeing a whittled away Barbie doll. I mean, that's very graphic. I think your imagination can run with that.
Yeah, but that's in many ways what new queer cinema was about. It was about In many ways, it was about shocking audiences. If you think about some of the more prominent films, and of course, Haynes then went on to direct Poison, which was one of the key films of new queer cinema. They were about confronting audiences, particularly as a response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, I guess they really needed to shock people to bring them out of their comfort zones to start thinking about what was happening in the world.
Yes, that's what he Haynes did as well in the next movie that he did. So he did he did the Karen Carpenter story, Superstar. Then he went on to do Poison. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to do Safe, which was his first collaboration with Julianne Moore.
And quite a well-received film. It kind of started to explore his move into more, not, I wouldn't say mainstream, but more,
accessible,
I guess, accessible films, even though it was quite a challenging film to watch.
I have to say I found the experience of watching it. I watched it a number of years ago. I found it a challenging film to watch. This is a film, Julianne Moore's character starts to become allergic, I suppose, have a reaction to the world, pretty much. You know, everything kind of sets her off and she has to become more and more isolated. It turns out that this was really a metaphor for, I guess, the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, which was something I was reading about today. And I in thinking about that film, I just remember her slowly pulling away from the world and everyone kind of dropping away from her. And then right at the end, her being so happy that she'd finally kind of given, gotten rid of everything, and she was stepping into this world of, you know, understand, accepting what was going on to her, and she's effectively becoming the girl in the bubble.
Girl in the bubble.
Yeah, and she was very, yeah, happy about that.
But you know, Greta Garbo, a total recluse.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I was watching an interview with Julianne and Todd, and they were talking about the film and about that ending being very Sirkian, because, of course, Douglas Sirk inspired a lot of Todd Haynes's work. Douglas Sirk had a fascination with the banal kind of suburban life of the housewife, I think, in the 1950s. But his films always, there was so much melodrama. And then at the very, very end, he kind of brought it around with a false happy ending.
Right.
And Todd Haynes was saying, in retrospect, he can really see the Sirkian influence on Safe, because there is that moment at the end where she thinks she's okay. But you just know that if the film was to go on for 5 minutes more, everything would fall apart again. This is Julianne and Todd talking about the experience of making Safe.
Independent film changed a lot of things for everybody. It just, there's suddenly a new avenue. You could actually have an artistic voice.
Right.
I actually think it's much different now and much harder, because the economic expectations for any kind of film are just completely, it's completely untenable. It's made it really impossible for people to do anything new. But at that point, we were given that tremendous freedom, and it really changed the way I thought about what I wanted to do with my career. It was 93 is the very, very beginning of it all.
Yeah.
And then there are a lot of people who feel disappointed to have missed that moment.
Yeah.
And I think that we were lucky to have had it.
Absolutely. Totally.
Well, that is, of course, Julianne and Todd Haynes talking about being part of this new independent movement in film, which was, of course, deeply imbricated with the new queer cinema movement, which, you know, would not have been had not there been this kind of evolving independent movement.
She sounded so young and enthusiastic.
It's interesting. He obviously gravitates towards strong female actresses and stories.
Yes.
It'd be really interesting to find out why that resonates with him so much.
Well, I think it's about it's about identity politics, and sometimes that is, you know, I don't know if this is my observation, but in film, certainly it's I think it's easier to deal with in film than with the same kind of identity problems that men have. I think we're used to seeing women struggle with their identity more than we are seeing men struggle with their identity. But actually, having just said that, you know, Haynes did go from this kind of aggressively experimental work to kind of dealing with glam rock in Velvet Goldmine, and then I'm Not There. And these films didn't really have strong female leads. They were about men. You know, the lead, Brian Slade in Velvet Goldmine, is David Bowie inspired.
But also quite androgynous. I mean, most of the characters were androgynous, so that he could actually play with both male and female roles within the male actor.
It seemed like they were more too of a connection to his love of music and to things that were really important to him, perhaps when he was growing up. It seemed like, you know, the glam rock thing and the Bob Dylan thing spoke to him on some level that tied back into what he's really passionate about.
And that's what's so fantastic about a director like Haynes. These are passion projects. These are not paycheck projects, as we said earlier. These are films that really say something about who he is. And in that way, he is a real auteur. He has kind of defined a new type of cinema.
But also I thought in Goldmine, the whole idea of this publicly created persona that gets killed off just like David Bowie and his Ziggy Stardust character. I think that's what he was playing with there, that whole idea of creating a mask, a character.
You're
for yourself,
so right.
And then killing it off. And then creating something
new. But
that's
what all of his films are about. Yeah. All of the leads in his films, or certainly most of them, have to contend with these publicly created personas and masks that they had no control over. Mm-hmm. And the films so often tend to be about their struggle with these characters and with these masks. And you know, how do I wear it? Can I wear it? Can I throw it off? And I would say more often than not, they can't. They don't. You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ Community Radio Station, Joy 94.9.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9, and we have been taking a look at the work of director Todd Haynes, who has just brought us Carol, which is now showing in cinemas.
We're flying through.
Well, we are flying through.
Yes,
we
have through this retrospective is moving along quite nicely.
What's up next?
Well, I think next was Far From Heaven, which is one of his better-known films. This was his second collaboration with Julianne Moore, and this is where you can really see the Serkian influences. And the film was, in fact, very heavily inspired by All That Heaven Allows, which is one of the better-known Douglas Sirk films with Rock Hudson, I believe.
Yeah, and Jane Wyman.
Mm. And Julianne Moore in this film was just mesmerizing. She was totally connected with her, and you felt for her at every stage. I mean, it was very, very emotional.
This film, so well written and so well acted, and, you know, even down to the cinematography and the costume design, everything was just right. You know, if you watch the film, it's got a very rich color palette, all yellows and reds, really autumnal colors.
Yeah, very much.
He's really good at putting together a cohesive cast, and I'm starting to see a little bit of a trend. He loves a redhead. So in this film, he also had Patricia Clarkson.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So, you know, if you talk, I mean, they are the holy trinity of redheads. Mm-hmm. Julianne Moore, Patricia Clarkson, and Cate Blanchett.
Yes.
He's like, I think I've cracked the code.
And then, of course, in Mildred,
is Kate a redhead? Code. Well, you know, she can be.
And so can Kate Winslet, who was in Mildred Pierce.
There you go. Oh. And Viola Davis was in Far From Heaven as well, which I think it kind of goes to show that he attracts people to projects that he appeals to actors and actresses who can see his vision.
People want to work with him.
Yeah. Yep. And he gets great people.
And you know, the funny thing, we were talking about Teen Sympathy last week, which was directed by Vincent Minnelli. And Vincent Minnelli's work was all shot in black and white, but he had this one colour that he used to mix into all of his, you know, the colour films, and that was this vibrant yellow. You can really see it in Teen Sympathy. But what I picked up revisiting Far From Heaven this week was that, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but Haynes, the world is, for Haynes, is saturated in that same hue of yellow. And it's just a really interesting kind of reference or homage that he evokes in this film. The film is, of course, about Julianne Moore, who plays a 1950s housewife, and her husband, played by Dennis Quaid, who, after X amount of years married, starts to have or act on feelings towards other men.
That's right. Yeah.
And then she, of course, there's a question about an affair for her with her gardener, who is African-American, and this is, of course, heavily frowned on at the time. And so she, again, as you were saying before, Alan, she has to kind of grapple and struggle with the role that is expected of her. It's kind of been thrust on her.
Yeah, that's right. I found that this film was more about the race relation than the homosexual husband, the gay content.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
I think it's the one part of that film that a lot of people don't immediately think of. You immediately go to the Dennis Quaid character and that whole thing. But the what was going on in 1950s America between, you know, and race relations was a really huge part of this film.
And in particular in Connecticut, which is that sort of really WASPy area, and they had very, very particular idea of where coloured people, that was their word, not mine,
fit
society.
Well, she does have to kind of grapple with what is expected of her, you know, and she is told frequently throughout the film that she can't have a relationship with Dennis Haysbert's character, the gardener here. But this is a clip from when, you know, Frank, her husband, confronts her about the relationship that he's been having. And I think the reason I chose it was because you really get a sense for how the film is played. You get a sense of the facade and the very superficial nature of all of these relationships. Mm-hmm. So this is Far From Heaven.
Pop, you'll never guess what I'm doing.
David, where is your coat?
It's in the garage.
And what's it doing there?
I'm waxing Pop's car. It's gonna look swell, Pop.
How many times do I have to tell you, children, you are not permitted outdoors in this kind of weather unless you're properly dressed?
Yes, ma'am.
You try talking some sense into them, Frank, because whatever I say doesn't... Frank, what's the matter? David, Janice, go upstairs to your rooms. Now. Now! Frank, what is it?
Something's happened. I've fallen in love with someone who wants to be with me. Kathy. I never knew what that felt. But I know that sounds so cruel, but... Oh, God, Kelly, I tried. I tried so hard to make it go away. And I thought that I could do it for you and for the kids. But I can't. I can't. I can't.
Soon, then, you'll be wanting a divorce.
I think that clip really works on so many levels because you have Quaid and Moore interacting with their children at the beginning, and it just feels so superficial, their interaction with their children. And then, of course, you have Dennis Quaid saying, I just can't do this anymore. I can't be this person that's expected of me. So you have that second layer of this struggle with identity.
Yeah, that's true. I'd agree with that. But Dennis's character in this is, I was completely unsympathetic to him. I mean, this is really about... I think he was quite selfish, and like where he's actually met this, the love of his life is actually a man who's probably in his late teens, and, yes. And Dennis is in his late 30s. And so he's found the love of his life while holidaying in Miami. I think, you know, it just didn't ring true. Whereas Julianne's character here, you totally feel for her that her life has just come crashing down. His life is about to start on a brand new adventure, but hers is
for
the one
for better or worse.
For better or for worse, yeah, but yeah. Hers is a wreckage.
Yeah. But I wonder if that's again, the homage coming through to All That Heaven Allows, because, of course, there's a moment in that film where I think it's Rock Hudson says, you know, you want love, but it's the idea of love that you want. You're not ready for a relationship. And I think you probably do get that sense with Dennis Quaid's character that that he's finally accessing this part of his identity that that he really wants, but he's probably not ready for the implications that will bring and the relationship that will ensue.
And I think there's another scene that comes on a little bit later on where he's actually... He's just calling through, doesn't care about his wife, his ex-wife, and he's just asking for the divorce papers. You know, so a very, very, again, as you said, very superficial relationship, very superficially asks about his children. Really all he wants that divorce so he can get on with his life. Doesn't care about her.
Remember that Haynes is someone who is deeply fascinated with the role of the housewife. Mm-hmm. And I think that highlights, you know, that lack of concern highlights the character that Kathy Whittaker, Julianne Moore's character, has to be. And we see the same dynamic between Kate Winslet and her partners in Mildred Pierce, which he went on to do next. And then even in Carol, there is that same dynamic. The male breadwinner shows very little concern for what goes on at home. And it's almost a weight on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see it crushing them, that they have to raise this family.
So what's he trying to say? Is he saying that we're living in a sea of superficiality and true depth and connection is so rare?
And strong redheads can get through anything. Yeah.
And that identity And the identities that are thrust on us are fundamentally flawed. And and I think there's probably something quite dark in there about the the inescapable nature of those identities, you know. How many of his characters actually do end up in a different spot at the end of the film to the spot that they were in the beginning? Actually, Carol, that's questionable about Carol. You know, she may well end up in a different spot.
It seems likely with everything that goes on that her life is going to continue to change quite drastically.
But then, of course, we know that Carol is someone who dips in and out of love affairs. So who knows what's, you know, whether this is just a repetition.
What's coming?
You know, I'd like to see Todd do something modern. We've seen a lot of period work. I'd like to see how he portrays our sense of identity and our relationships in the modern age.
Safe was modern.
How would he have fun with that?
I think Safe is the one film that comes to mind.
But it was very contained.
Yes.
You know, so he kept it in this very small area. It would be interesting to see him branch out and look at modern society and explore a modern relationship with his eye.
That's right, because Kate was saying how his vision has changed, or his aesthetic has changed from, as you're saying, very, very confronting to now being, you know, still quite visual and it's quite nuanced, and what's not said, the reflections is what she mentioned. So it'd be interesting to see how he does the modern life.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You're listening to Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
We're wrapping up our discussion about Todd Haynes and Carol. And it's kind of quite interesting. We started off talking about the Academy Awards. And I was saying I was reading an article with Phyllis Nagy, and she was talking about what her big hope for Carol is not that it's this huge success and, you know, she makes gazillions of dollars off
it,
or any
nice.
Of them do.
But, that'd be nice.
If that happens, that'd
I'm sure
be lovely.
She won't say no.
But that it opens the door for more films about women. And she said, and I'm not saying more films about lesbian women. She was like, I just love to see two or three films come out of this that have the Carol effect.
Well, that's what she said in the interview, actually, that we were listening to earlier. She thinks that the reason it took 18 years to make, and that people are only ready for it now, if that, is not because it was a lesbian story, but because it was a story about two women. And that's a bit of an indictment, really.
What about Thelma and Louise?
Well, she mentioned Thelma and Louise, and she said, you know, if you actually think about it, it's like 20 years ago. Okay. So she was like, you know, it's kind of looking for those films. In my head, I was thinking, we've got an all-female Ghostbusters coming out this year. You know, and it's kind of, I mean, with all the crap that came out when they made that announcement, it kind of just goes to show how important it is that they do keep pushing ahead and have strong female films.
But Ghostbusters is going to be a comedy, and there are a lot of comedies with strong female casts. It's really the dramas where people just don't go to watch two women. And maybe that is why Carol has been snubbed. Anyway, that's really
an interesting point, but let's hope that's not the case.
Yeah.
That's really all we've got time for this evening. You're listening to Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.